Well, I must say I don't believe in curses and all that sort of bulldust. Tinus laughed a little too loudly. His inhibitions were weighed down around his ankles. That makes two of us, agreed Ral Davidson.
It's not a supernatural thing, Leslie told them primly. It's a fungus disease.
I seem to have lost control of the situation completely, so I raised my voice. If you're all finished, I'll go on. Which got their attention back to me. The conditions would have been ideal for the development of Cryptococcus neuromyces, a fungoid saprophytic growth whose airborne spores are the cause of a fatal disease. What does it do? Tinus asked. The spores are breathed into the lungs, and in the warm, moist conditions they germinate almost immediately and develop into dense granulitic colonies.
Size, said Tinus, which is an expression of the deepest disgust.
You mean it starts growing on your lungs, like that green stuff on moldy bread?
What are the consequences? Lurin asked.
I had it word perfect.
Primarily, they're extensive lesions of the lung tissue, with hemorrhage, high temperature, and rapidly painful breathing. But then the fungoid colonies begin generating wastes, which are readily absorbed into the blood and carried to the brain and the central nervous system.
My God!
Tinus was blanched and horrified. His blue eyes stared out of the white, freckled face.
And then what happens?
Well, the wastes act as a virulent neurotoxin and induce hallucination. There is inflammation of the meninges and severe brain malfunction, similar to the effects of lysergic acid or mescaline.
Groovy, said Ral, and Leslie kicked his shin.
You mean it drives you crazy? Tinus demanded.
Clean out of your little skull, Sally assured him.
Fatal? Asked Lorin.
75%, depending on individual immunity and the rate of antibody formation.
In the event of survival, is there permanent damage?
Scarring of the lungs, similar to healed tuberculosis.
Brain damage?
No, I shook my head.
Hell, man, said Tinus, carefully setting his glass down. I don't know that I'm so keen on this deal. Rockfalls, methane gas, pressure bursts, those don't worry me. But this fungus thing, he shuddered. It's creepy, man. Just plain bloody creepy.
What precautions are you going to take, Ben? Loudon asked.
The first party in will be protected by respirators, I explained. I'll take air and dust samples for microscopic examination.
Lorin nodded and smiled at Tinus. Satisfied?
Well, what will you do if you don't find it? But it's sort of lurking there. You know, like ready to pounce. Like in those science fiction books.
Tinus hedged.
If it is there, it'll be thick. Every dust sample will be full of it. You can't miss it under the microscope. A black three-ball structure like a pawnbroker's sign.
Are you sure, Doc?
I'm sure, Tinus.
He took a deep breath, hesitated a moment longer, and then nodded.
Okay, Doc. I'll trust you, he said.
The buffeting, fluttering roar of the rock drills chased my agonized brain into a corner of my skull and started kicking into a jelly. The party had ended in the early hours.
How you feeling, Doc?
Tinus van Vuren came across to where I stood watching the work and shouted above the din. My nerves vibrated like guitar strings. Tinus looked as fresh and baby-faced as though his nightcap had been hot milk and honey, and he'd slept 12 hours. I knew the type. Lorin was one of them.
I feel bloody awful, thanks, I shouted back.
Well, there won't be anything to see here for a couple of days, Tinus told him.
Why don't you go lie down for a bit, Doc?
I'll stick around, I said, which seemed to be the general sentiment.
Lorin piloted the course of the Stuyvesant Empire from the radio shack, unable to tear himself away from the City of the Moon. Sally made a few desultory attempts at cataloguing and filing, but these never lasted more than an hour or two, and then she was back at the cavern. Ral and Leslie made no pretense and spent all day in the cavern, except for brief simultaneous absences, which Lorin and I guessed were exercise periods. Tinas was a top man in his trade, and his team cut the tunnel swiftly and skillfully. The walls were shaped smoothly and precisely. They were shored with heavy timber baulks, and electric lights were strung along the roof. 30 feet in, Tinas constructed a large chamber, from which a new drive was made, aimed at the area behind the painting of the White King. Tinas and I had made careful measurements and calculations, and we decided exactly where we could expect to strike whatever the wall of masonry concealed. The Bantu drill men were warned of the need for respirators, and Tinas and I crouched behind them in the cramped rock tunnel as they began the assault on the last few feet of rock. Their backs were naked, glistening bunches of black muscles as they worked the heavy drills. The noise in the confined space was thunderous, and despite the ventilation fan circulating air, the heat was appalling. The sweat poured down inside the face masks of my respirator, and the eye goggles were fogged and blurry. The tension was becoming almost painful, as the long steel bit of the drill hammered itself into the rock, sinking in inch by inch, the muddy, lubricating water running back from the drill hole. I glanced sideways at Tinas. He appeared monstrous in the black rubber mask, but the blue eyes twinkled out of the eyeglasses, and he winked and held up a thumb in a gesture of assurance. Suddenly, the drill man was thrown off balance as the drill ran away with him. It slid unresisted into its hole, and he staggered wildly as he tried to control the enormous weight of steel. Tinas slapped his shoulder, and he slammed the valve of the drill closed. The silence was almost painful, and our labored breathing was the only sound. Through, I thought. We've holed through, but into God knows what. I saw my own excitement reflected in Tinas's blue eyes. I nodded at him, and he turned and tapped the drill men's shoulders and jerked his thumb in a gesture of dismissal. They shuffled back, bowed in the low tunnel, and disappeared around the bend. Two of us went forward and crouched at the face. Gingerly we withdrew the drill steel from its hole, and a wisp of fine dust followed it out, smoking in the harsh glare of the electric lights. Tinas and I exchanged glances. Then I jerked my head at Tinas. He nodded, and followed his gang back along the tunnel. I worked on alone at the face. I used the long plastic rod, with a piece of sterile white cloth attached to the end of it, to probe the drill hole to its limit. It ran 14 feet into the rock before meeting resistance, and when I withdrew it, the cloth was thick with grey, floury dust. I dropped it into the sample bottle and attached another cloth to the rod. In all, I collected 6 separate samples before I followed Tinas back along the passage. There was a bench and an angle-poise lamp set up ready for me in the rock chamber. The microscope was under the light with its mirror adjusted, and it was the work of only a few minutes to smear my dust samples onto the slides and spread the red dye over them. It was difficult to get a view into the eyepiece of the microscope through my befogged goggles. One quick scrutiny was sufficient, but I doggedly inspected all 6 samples before I ripped off my respirator and sucked big, relieved breaths. Then I scampered down the passage and out into the cavern. They were all waiting for me, crowding around me eagerly.
"We've drilled into a cavity," I shouted, "and it's clean." Then they were on me, pounding my back, shaking my hand, laughing and chattering excitedly. Lorin would let no one else work with me at the face, though Ral and Sally were clearly breaking their hearts to do so. The two of us worked carefully, slowly chipping away at the drill hole with chisel and a 4-pound hammer, enlarging it gradually until we'd exposed a slab of dressed masonry. It was a massive slab of red sandstone, which blocked off the end of our tunnel from floor to roof and from wall to wall. It was obviously the lining of the cavity into which the drill had bored. The drill hole cut through the center of it like a single black eye socket. All our efforts to peer through it were rewarded with a vista of impenetrable blackness, and we had to content ourselves with a slower, painstaking approach. For 3 days we worked shoulder to shoulder, stripped to the waist, chipping steadily at the living rock until, despite our gloves, our hands were mushy with blisters and smeared skin. Slowly we exposed the massive slab over its full width and height, to find that it butted on either side against identical slabs, and that it appeared to carry across its summit the cross pieces of an equally massive stone lintel. We used 2 50-ton hydraulic jacks to take the strain of the lintel off the slab. Then we drilled and attached ring bolts to the slab itself and hooked steel chains to them. We jammed a brace of steel H-sections across the tunnel to anchor the chains, and with 2 heavy ratchet winches we began to haul the slab bodily out of its seating. We knelt side by side, each of us straining against one of the winches, taking up the pull, one pawl at a time. With each click of the ratchet, the strain on the chains increased until they were as rigid as solid steel bars. Now the handles of the winches were almost immovable.
"Okay, Ben, let's both get into one of them," Lauren panted.
His golden curls were dark and heavy with sweat and dirt, plastered against his skull, and the sweat highlighted his great shoulder muscles and the straining, swollen biceps as we heaved together at the winch. Clank went the ratchet, and the chain moved 1/16 of an inch. Clank, and again she moved. Our breathing hissed and whistled in the silence.
"All the way, partner," Lorin gasped beside me. "All the way, low,"
and my body arched like a drawn bow. I felt the muscles in my back begin to tear, my eyes strained from their sockets. And then, with a soft grating sound, the great slab of sandstone swung slowly out of the face, and then fell with a heavy thump to the floor of the tunnel, and beyond it we saw the square black opening. We lay together side by side, fighting for breath, sweat trickling down our faces and bodies, our muscles still quivering and twitching from our exertions, and we stared into that sinister hole. There was a smell, a stale, long-dead, dry smell, as the air that had been trapped in there for 2,000 years gushed out.
"Come."
Lorin was the first to move. He scrambled to his feet and snatched up one of the electric bulbs in its little wire cage. The extension cable slithered after him like a snake as he went forward. I followed him quickly and we crawled through the opening. It was a jump of 4 feet down to the floor of the chamber beyond. We stood side by side, Lorin holding the light above his head, and we peered round us into the moving, mysterious shadows. We were in a long, commodious passage that ran straight and undeviatingly 155 feet from the cavern end to terminate against a blank wall of stone. The passage was 8 foot 6 inches high and 10 foot wide.
The roof was lined with lintels of sandstone, laid horizontally from wall to wall, and the walls themselves were tiled with blocks similar to the one we'd removed from its seating. The floor was paved with square flags of sandstone. Let into the walls on each side of the passage were stone-lined cupboards. These were 7 feet wide and 5 feet deep, and reached from floor to roof height. Each of these recesses was fitted with shelves of stone slab, rank upon rank of them, 3 feet apart, and upon the shelves stood hundreds upon hundreds of pottery jars.
"Some sort of storeroom," Lurin said, holding the light high and moving slowly down the passage.
"Yes. Here's probably wine or corn in the jars." I have never learnt not to guess aloud. My heart was hammering with excitement, and my head swiveled from side to side as I tried to take in every detail. There were 20 of these recesses, 10 on each side of the passage, and I guessed again. "Let's open one." Lurin was consumed by a layman's impatience. No, Lo, we can't do that until we're ready to work properly." There was a thick, soft shroud of pale dust over everything. It softened the outlines and edges of all shapes. It rose lazily around our legs like a sea mist as our movements stirred it.
"We'll have to clean up before we can do anything else," I said, and sneezed as the dust found its way into my nostrils.
"Well, move slowly," Lurin told me. "Don't stir it up." He took a further pace and then stopped.
"What's this?"
Scattered along the passage floor were dozens of large, shapeless objects, their identity concealed by the blanketing dust. They were lying singly or in heaps, strange, fluid shapes that teased my memory. Compared with the orderly ranks of jars on their shelves, the objects were strewn with a careless abandon. "Hold the lamp," I told Lurin, and crouched over one of them. I touched it gently, running my fingers through the velvety dust, brushing it softly aside, until I recognized what it was, and I drew back with an involuntary exclamation of surprise. Through the soft mist of dust and ages, a face stared up at me. A long-dead, mummified face, over which was stretched dry, tobacco-brown skin. The eyes were empty, dark holes, and the lips had dried and shrunken to expose the grinning yellow teeth.
"Dead men," Lurin said. "Dozens of them."
"Sacrifices?" I pondered. No, this is something else."
"Looks like a battle, as though they'd been killed in a fight."
Now that we knew what they were, it was possible to make out the way the bodies were piled upon each other like the debris of a hurricane, or were thrown loosely about the stone floor. A corpse in a mantle of grey dust sat with his back to the wall. His head sagged forward on his chest, and one outflung arm had knocked four of the jars from their shelf. They lay on the floor beside him, like fat rolls of French bread.
"It must have been a hell of a fight," I said with awe.
"It was," said Lurin softly, and I turned to him with surprise. His eyes glowed with some intense inner excitement, and his lips were parted, a reckless half-smile on his lips.
"What do you mean?" I demanded.
"How do you know that?" Lurin looked at me. For a second or two he didn't see me, and then his eyes focused.
"Eh?" he said, puzzled.
"Why did you say that? As though you knew."
"Did I?" he asked.
"I don't know. I meant... it must have been."
He moved on slowly down the passage, stepping over the wind rows of dead men, peering in each recess as he passed, and I followed him slowly. My mind was thrashing around like a corralled bull, charging madly at each fleeting idea that crossed its path, spinning back on its track and charging again. I knew there was no chance of it being capable of calm, logical thought until this first surging excitement waned. Of one thing, and one thing only, I was certain. This was big. This was something to rank with Leakey's discoveries at Olduvai Gorge, something to startle and dazzle the world of archaeology, something that I'd prayed for and dreamed about for 20 years.